Number four, periodic status review, the northern spotted owl, snowy plover, western gray squirrel, and greater sage grouse. This is a briefing and public hearing, and Penny, I will turn it over to you and others.
Good morning, Chair Smith, members of the Commission, Director Unsworth, and Deputy Director Storr. I'm Penny Becker. It's really great to be with you again. And it's my pleasure to have three other staff from our Wildlife Programs Diversity Division with me today, Joe Buchanan, Derek Stinson, and Gary Wiles. And today they're going to work with me to help brief you on four periodic status reviews for the species that you just announced. And if you remember, we came to you last year to give you an update on our periodic status reviews and just the general that we're embarking on this big process to look at reviewing all of our state-listed species. So we currently have 46 state-listed species, and by WAC requirement, we have to look at updating those on periodic status. And so really what we are required to do is to ask the Commission whether you would like to uplist the species, downlist the species, or even delist it if we feel like it's met its recovery goals, or to say that the species doesn't require a change in status. We should keep it protected at the level at which it stands. Those definitions that we use for our recommendations are within the WAC. So you'll notice, if you're familiar with the Endangered Species Act, definitions of endangered and threatened, the difference we have with our state classifications is that we have another category, which is sensitive. And that's really for our species that are vulnerable and declining, but haven't yet reached that threshold of threatened or endangered. And then, of course, we'll come to you with a recommendation that the species does not need to be on the protected list or endangered list if it doesn't meet any of those definitions. The process for periodic status reviews is quite a lengthy one by requirement in the WAC. And so we began in February 2014 by announcing the first batch of species that we are embarking on periodic status reviews. And that allowed any members of the public that might have information to contribute to those reviews to be able to send them into the department, and we can use those and compile them in our status review documents. So we asked for that specific information from anyone that might have anything to contribute. That information then is pulled together by our very hardworking staff into these documents, along with, of course, literature reviews and other expert information from external sources. And then that goes through a rigorous review process. So once our DFW Biologist and Diversity Division drafts that document, it will go to other species experts throughout the agency, and then it will go to external experts. So whether that might be to biologists in other federal agencies or to other sister state agencies, to academia, et cetera, others that might have information on the species. Then we go into a 90-day public comment period that's required, and then the public has another shot at not only looking at all the information we put together, but also the findings that we had to say, what's our recommendation for this species? Does it need to be uplisted, downlisted, or kept the same? So then we compile all that information and comments we get from the public, and we put it together within the finalized periodic status review with responses to the comments that we received. And just a reminder, Our public affairs staff did a really great job of making it easy for the public to comment on these status reviews. So there's a page up on our website, and we put out a press release to say, hey, these are the species that we're looking at now. This is how you can contribute information. You simply click there, and you can either attach information or insert any information you have to contribute. This is our hefty load of species, 46 species, that we've been working on updating their status. And really, you don't have to read every species in there. I just wanted to show you, you know, our concept is batching it in three groups for public comment and to try to have bite-sized chunks of work for our staff to do. Today, we're going to be talking about spotted owl, western gray squirrel, greater sage grouse, and snowy plover. And so what we'll do is we'll go through each species separately, and we'll have some time for questions after each one. And then we'll ask for your decision based upon our recommendations in February. Any questions before we get started? Great. Okay. First up is spotted owl.
Chair Smith and members of the commission, my name is Joe Buchanan, and I'll be talking with you about the status of the spotted owl in Washington. The spotted owl was listed in Washington State by the Fish and Wildlife Commission in 1988, followed 2 years later by its ESA listing as threatened. The primary reason for listing at the ESA level was loss and degradation of habitat. And at that time, the Department of Fish and Wildlife deferred to a federal recovery plan that was in discussion, but it was quite some time before it was completed. The spotted owl is found in the Cascades and Olympic Peninsula of Washington and a few other places, for example, in southwestern Washington. You can see from the map here. These are watersheds that at one time or another have supported spotted owls over the last three or four decades. So probably at some point in time, going back longer than that, they were probably found in many other low elevation conifer forests. The habitat of the spotted owl is generally described as structurally complex, mature, and old forest. They use that habitat for nesting, roosting, foraging, and probably dispersal. The forest is characterized by having large snags, downed wood, multiple canopy layers, moderate to high canopy closure. So it's sort of, it has that structural complexity of a forest that is older. And in the Eastern Cascades, mistletoe is an important component of forest used by spotted owls. And it's in this habitat that the spotted owls forage for their prey. They consume primarily small mammals, a variety of different species, the most important one being the northern flying squirrel. Home ranges of spotted owls are very, very large. They're the largest documented, the Washington home ranges are the largest documented by scientific investigation of any area in the range of the northern spotted owl, which extends from British Columbia to northern California. And as an example, on the Olympic Peninsula, the median annual home range is over 14,000 acres. That's equivalent to a circle with a 2.7-mile radius. In the Cascades, the area is equivalent to a 1.8-mile radius circle, and those are the circle sizes that are used for regulatory management purposes in both forest practices rules and as take guidelines by the federal government. The population status of northern spotted owls is being evaluated at 11 demography study areas in Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. And declines have been documented at 7 of those 11 study areas. A paper was just released here about a month ago by Duggar et al. That reports on this information. The declines are most substantial in Washington and northern Oregon. We have three demography study areas in Washington State. So these are the Klee Elum, the Olympic National Park, and vicinity, and the area in and around Mount Rainier National Park. And as you can see, The values at the bottom of the screen here indicate population declines that range between about 3.9 and 8.4%. That's over the entire period of monitoring, which in all of these study areas is in excess of 20 years. And I'll show a graph about that here in a minute. Very quickly, these are the three study areas. They're landscape level areas that involve typically upwards of 100 or more territories of spotted owls, so they're very, very large samples. And the other study areas and other areas of the Northwest are similar in size. So this graph demonstrates those levels of population change that I showed two slides earlier. So these range from 3.9 to 8.4% per year. And so this is kind of what it looks like on a graph. So if we look at the left side there, starting with a population of just kind of a conceptual population of 100, this is what those population declines would look like. So the worst case scenario is the Klee Elum. Over a period of about 20 years, that population would have changed from 100 individuals to approximately 20. So that's the kind of population change we're looking at. And that start point kind of coincides with about the time the species was listed. The monitoring in these study areas all started between about 89 and about 91. Limiting factors, a variety of limiting factors have been, or potential limiting factors have been identified. I've kind of highlighted the ones that are the most important. So timber harvest and fire in certain landscapes, and then there's, my pointer's not working very well, and then competitive interactions with barred owls. And I'll talk about these things here in a minute. Habitat management efforts in Washington State are quite varied. On federal lands, we have the Northwest Forest Plan, which really guides the way that federal lands are managed. Fish and Wildlife Service identified critical habitat. Most of that is on federal lands. And the Fish and Wildlife Service does a lot of consulting with federal agencies on spotted owl and other kinds of resource management issues. On private and state lands, we have a number of habitat conservation plans that have been developed with non-federal entities, so state and private primarily. And then we also have forest practices rules. And those forest practices rules are really focused in landscapes that were thought to be the key non-federal areas where spotted owl conservation would be important. The Forest Service conducts a review every 5 years of the Northwest Forest Plan, and so this is a summary of habitat changes on federal lands and non-federal lands. So that first row for federal lands, you can see the third column over, wildfire is really the largest type of habitat change or habitat loss that has occurred on federal lands in Washington. On non-federal lands, most of the habitat loss is related to timber harvest. The barred owl has kind of complicated things a little bit. This species is native to eastern North America. It's found primarily east of the Mississippi River, but over the last century, it has expanded its range across the continent. This has been documented with a lot of over 10,000 records that kind of show the progression. And the species arrived in Washington in the 1960s, and it now occupies the entire range of the northern spotted owl from British Columbia to Northern California. This species is a habitat and prey generalist, which means that it can use a kind of a wide variety of prey and habitat types. They have smaller home ranges, probably because they can use a variety of prey and habitats. They produce, they lay more eggs, produce more young. They have a greater dispersal ability. They're slightly larger than a spotted owl, and they're thought to be more aggressive. We don't really understand that very well, but there have been some anecdotal accounts of interactions. A number of papers have been published over the last few years that indicate that there is actually a negative interaction between the barred owl and spotted owl. So in light of that, the Fish and Wildlife Service, with some consultation with the Barred Owl Working Group, developed an environmental impact statement in 2013 that outlined the goals and other aspects of conducting an experiment at a variety of landscape level study sites in the Pacific Northwest to remove barred owls. So study goals were to better understand the relationship of the two species, to assess whether there's a lower level of barred owl presence on a landscape where spotted owls would still be able to persist and recover. And also ultimately to allow for some kind of a cost estimate that would be associated with an ongoing program if this is an effective experiment. We don't have any results yet from the Washington State study site. So there's one of these study sites is in Washington where the removal experiments are occurring. The removal is occurring, but the barred owl monitoring hasn't occurred. And in about 4 years, we'll have a full analysis of that. I would add, though, at this point that there is yet another study in Northern California that has been going on for 4 years, and the results of that study have shown that spotted owls respond very favorably, very positively, when the barred owls are removed from the landscape. Recovery needs, just a brief review of those. Forest health and fire risk is a really big issue in the Eastern Cascades, especially in the dry forest landscape, and so that needs to be addressed in a way that kind of balances the forest health and human safety issues with protecting spotted owl habitat. There have been a number of papers published on that, and there's a lot of really positive I think perception about opportunities there. And then Department of Fish and Wildlife and other stakeholders have been working on conservation incentives, a program to incentivize conservation, especially on private lands. And these activities include easements, mitigation banking, carbon sequestration, safe harbor agreements, and things like that. Importantly, the outcome of the barred owl removal experiment should provide really important information on the feasibility of a long-term ongoing project and the cost of maintenance control. Maintenance control being essentially the ongoing activity to manage populations. Then lastly, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is currently conducting a 5-year review and assessing federal status of the spotted owl. I don't have a timeline for that, but I believe that effort is underway, and so sometime, hopefully in the next year or so, we should have information back from the service. So given the continuing population decline of the spotted owl in Washington, which is already identified as a state endangered species, the recommendation is to retain the northern spotted owl as a state endangered species. We had a variety of public comments. We had about 30 letters and emails. We had three folks who, with three exceptions, there was a strong emphasis on maintaining or retaining the endangered status of the spotted owl. Three people thought that it really wasn't really very important to them. And then just a couple of comments. One was one person felt that barred owl removal wasn't going to be very effective strategy, but the result in California, in fact, has shown that that is not the case, at least in California. And then one comment was that barred owls were really an unimportant factor and that the issue was really habitat. And so that's kind of the scope of the public comments. And so with that, I will entertain any questions you have.
Questions? Yes.
What does barred owl removal entail?
based on the California experiment, for example?
Chair Smith and Commissioner Graybill, the California project and the method that's being used in Washington is primarily lethal removal. So it involves using a shotgun. The approach is to use barred owl vocalizations to attract the barred owls. They come in, they respond, they come in, and then remove them with the shotgun. The shotguns that are being used in California actually have silencers on them so that it's not disruptive if it's within some proximity to human dwellings. Most of these sites are out in large forest areas away from human activities, so that's not an issue for us in Washington State. The barred owl working group that was working with the Fish and Wildlife Service designed and distributed a questionnaire to all of the states from about the Mississippi eastward and asked if we could, or if any of those states were interested in having barred owls that we physically captured and moved back east, and every single state said we don't want them. So it made it really clear to the Fish and Wildlife Service that that was not going to be an effective removal strategy.
Thank you. Commissioner Thumber.
Thank you. The report was extremely informative. I might add depressing. There's a big focus on the barred owl as having a huge impact on whether or not this bird is going to survive. But it also, we're throwing climate change into the mix. And certainly habitat is, as you pointed out, the other big area of concern. Are we continuing to look at home range size? It seems like it's interesting that in Washington the home range is so much larger than in other areas. We've had major impacts on habitat with forest practices in the past. And now with climate change coming in, there are going to be other impacts on habitat, and it seems like home range size might be a way of monitoring that. I'd just be interested in some of your comments on that, and that we're keeping it on the front burner as well as barred owls.
Yeah. Chair Smith, Commissioner Thornburn, I don't know if there are studies planned to evaluate changes in home range size. Climate change information is being developed over the last few years, especially about the kinds of changes that we might expect to see in forests. And some of the concern, especially in the Eastern Cascades, is that some of the forests that are being used by spotted owls currently might be changing so much over the next 50 to 100 years that the species composition might be primarily ponderosa pine, which is a species that spotted owls don't really use, which would be replacing Douglas fir, because Douglas fir would not be able to persist in such a dry climate. So that's a concern. One of the other climate change concerns is that some of the modeling and some of the expert opinion about climate change effects has to do with the kinds of forest fires that we have. So the Eastern Cascade forests are already sort of outside the historical range of variability, according to a lot of the scientific information that's been generated. And so that was one of the images that I showed there, is sort of that balance of forest management to address fire risk and forest health, but also providing habitat for species. And some of the work that's been done, modeling work, shows that it should be possible to more intensively manage a small portion of the landscape in a way to create fire breaks and maybe a more appropriate type of patterning of the forest to reduce that risk. So that's an issue that is thought will increase and become more severe with climate change. But if we can be proactive and start to develop some of those kinds of forest management strategies now and in the near-term future, that should alleviate some of those concerns.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mackin.
On page 9, one statement there refers to hybridization between the two owls, which would indicate to me that they're probably genetically fairly similar. And if this is a natural extension of the range of the species, and this is a natural process of hybridization of two closely related species, how do you justify lethal removal?
Chair Smith, Commissioner Ankin, that's one of the big questions. But there is some information to indicate that the movement across the continent was strongly influenced by human activity. When we plot out, actually I haven't done this, but a colleague of mine spent probably a decade of his life pulling together about 10,000 records of barred owl detections from about the Mississippi River across the entirety of the continent. And the subsequent analysis and publication of that information showed a pretty compelling, fairly steady progression along the major rivers of the Great Plains, starting probably over 100 years ago. And one of the hypotheses that that has been put forth is that the Gallery Forest, the riparian forest along those rivers, have grown and developed quite substantially beginning about 100 years ago with the removal of the bison from the Great Plains. The bison formerly were found in herds of millions of animals and would make river crossings that in some cases would prevent establishment of forest. And so when the bison were removed and settlers became or started moving west and established windbreaks and, you know, firewood sources and things like that, it's thought that those kinds of changes created woodlands that the barred owls could then use as migration corridors. And so when all of these records are plotted out at like 10-year increments, you can just see this steady movement of barred owls along those rivers. So that's probably how or at least that's one of the hypotheses about how the owls moved across the landscape. They are closely related to the spotted owl, and that's one of the reasons why there's competition. Usually when you have two species that are not closely related, they usually have a different kind of a niche that that each occupies, and they're able to coexist, but they are closely related. And one of the consequences of the barred owl being present now in the Pacific Northwest is that it is now a dominant nocturnal avian predator that is novel in this environment in the Pacific Northwest. And none of the species that are found out here have any history adapting to the presence of that particular species. And so there are a variety of species that agencies like the Department of Fish and Wildlife, but agencies throughout the range are becoming concerned about because they may be vulnerable to this new predatory pressure that is being manifested, you know, by the presence of the barred owl.
Is there evidence of hybridization?
Yes.
It says.
Yes.
I might be presuming, but following up on what I think might be your line of thinking, if hybridization could contribute to survivability of the species, but isn't generally there a question about fertility of the offspring of hybrids? I mean, we're finding it more and more often in bird species, but are they really contributing to population viability when they're hybridizing?
There are some back crosses that are so the birds are hybridizing, and then their offspring are also breeding. but hybridization, that has been documented, but it turns out that it was probably more noticeable when barred owls were first coming into the Pacific Northwest, because they were interacting with a species that was still fairly common, and they were still fairly uncommon. At least that's kind of my understanding of it. I think most of the experts now believe that the issue of hybridization is probably not very important, because barred owls have become so abundant. The real issue is the competitive interaction for food resources and simply space. It's a territorial issue. So I think it's really about competition at this point, and hybridization probably still happens, but it's probably very, very rare.
I must caution about time.
We're
running away from time. Any final comments on? Is that it?
Yes.
Okay.
Penny?
Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Okay, next up we have Western gray squirrels.
Commissioner Holtzmiller, you will refrain from any comments. Forewarned is forearmed.
Good morning, Chair Smith and members of the Commission. My name is Gary Wiles, I'm a staff biologist with the Diversity Division, and I'll be giving you an update on the status of western gray squirrels in Washington this morning. But first, I want to remind you that we have two types of gray squirrels in the state. The western is our native species, and the eastern gray squirrel has been introduced. The two are fairly similar in appearance, and therefore that can cause a fair amount of confusion amongst the public as to which species is which, and can often result in mistaken impressions that western gray squirrels are much more common than they really are. So the two are separable by looking at the amount of brown in the fur color. Western grays don't have any brown except sometimes on the backs of the ears, whereas eastern gray squirrels have brown mixed in through the tail and the head and the body. We look at the distribution of the two species. We'll start off with the western gray squirrel on the left there at the map. And we currently have three populations in the state. Largest of these is in the Klickitat region. We have a population in the North Cascades, and then also our smallest population is in the southern Puget Trough. And historically, the species occurred along the entire eastern flank of the lower Cascades, and then westward through the Columbia Gorge to Vancouver or so, and then northward up to about Pierce County. The eastern gray squirrel is a much more urbanized species, and you can tell that by seeing the extensive distribution around the Puget Sound area. But it also occurs in cities and towns scattered throughout the rest of the state. And the two species overlap in only a couple of areas. One of those is around Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and then also in the southwestern part of Klickitat County. So that's pretty much all I'll say about eastern gray squirrels. The rest of the time we'll be discussing western gray squirrels here. Western gray squirrels are found, their entire distribution ranges from Washington southward through Oregon and California and down into northern Mexico. They're a forest species, and they prefer areas where conifer stands mix or merge with oak forests and sometimes other deciduous trees. Ponderosa pine, Douglas fir, and Oregon white oak are important components of western gray squirrel habitat. Squirrels like forest stands that have larger trees in them, and that's because trees of that size provide better food resources and nesting resources. And they also prefer areas where the tree canopy is connected and there's open ground cover. The diet is comprised mostly of fungi, conifer seeds, such as Douglas fir and ponderosa pine, and also acorns. Females produce one litter a year, and that averages about three squirrels. Litters are born in the spring and summer. Squirrels use two types of nests, stick nests and tree cavities, and those are used for protection from weather, for resting, and then also for rearing young. And home range sizes in Washington are very variable. They range from anywhere from 45 to over 1,000 acres in size. Western gray squirrel was made a state threatened species in Washington in 1993. In 2007, the agency produced a recovery plan for the western gray squirrel, and we consider that an important document for several reasons. But one of these is it's the only, it provides the only population estimate that's ever been derived for the species in Washington. And this was admittedly a pretty crude estimate, but you can see by the range of the confidence intervals that there's it's quite wide, but the estimate was 937 squirrels for the entire state, and about three quarters of those were in the Klickitat region. And the recovery plan also provides some objectives for downlisting the species to sensitive status, and I won't run through these specifically, but the objective was that all of those had to be achieved, and also adequate habitat protection measures also had to be achieved for downlisting to occur. So it's not a region by region downlisting, but it would be the entire state. Looking at our current periodic status review, then, I should mention that we were petitioned by a member of the public to consider this a priority, and therefore we bumped it up into our first batch of reviews that we did. Since the 2007 recovery plan, there's been very little population assessment work been done on the species. And because of that, for this current review, we had to be pretty cautious in our assessment of how the three populations are doing or have done over the past decade or so. The southern Puget Trough population, we say in the report that there's been a probable increase in abundance. This is due to a series of translocations that were done on Joint Base Lewis-McChord and also habitat assessment there that has occurred on the base. In the North Cascades, we're seeing a possible decrease in squirrel numbers. And this would be due primarily to the large fires that have occurred there in the past two summers. There's been no formal assessment of the impacts of those fires, however, so we're simply saying a possible decrease there. And likewise, for the Klickitat region, a possible decrease there. Again, it's habitat-related, probably through timber harvest. And as part of our review, we did a preliminary habitat analysis, and it showed that for Klickitat County, about 12% of habitat has been altered for western gray squirrels over the past 10 years. And when I say altered, I mean it's no longer suitable for the squirrels. If we look at the factors that threaten this species, it is a forest species, so of course anything that causes forest loss or degradation or fragmentation will be a problem for it. And this can result from timber harvest, wildfires, and also fire exclusion activities. Small population size is a problem for the southern Puget Trough population. It can result in inbreeding and also stochastic events that can affect the population. Mange has been a problem in the Klickitat population. It occurs in periodic outbreaks of, I think, about 10 to 20 years or so, and when it does happen, it can be quite a source of mortality for the population. And then other factors include climate change and how it affects the occurrence of wildfires. Highway mortality is a factor in all three populations, or does occur in all three populations, and introduced wildlife, and I'm thinking there primarily of possible competition with eastern gray squirrels and wild turkeys for food resources. Regarding recent conservation actions, the department updated its priority habitats and species recommendations for the western gray squirrel in 2010, and those are recommendations on how private landowners can manage their forest lands to benefit squirrels. The department also reviews forest practices applications that have the potential to affect western gray squirrels. In those cases, our staff contact the forest owner and ask if they would be willing to implement certain measures to reduce the impacts of their harvest on the squirrels. So these are voluntary guidelines on the part of the landowner. They don't have to accept them. Translocations to Joint Base Lewis-McChord occurred in 2007 to 12 and involved 93 squirrels brought to the base from other locations. Habitat restoration mainly around in and around Joint Base Lewis-McChord, but it's also occurred for the other populations. We've begun a major effort to survey western gray squirrels. Starting this past summer, we're doing a three-year effort to assess all three populations, and we use hair snag tubes placed along transect lines to do this. And then in regards to research, we have a staff research scientist with the wildlife program who devotes a fair amount of his time to this species. And there's also been a couple of very good PhD studies that have come out in the past 4 or 5 years that have looked at habitat use and possible competition with eastern gray squirrels. So our periodic status review is recommending that the commission retain the species as a threatened species. The reasons for this are that two of the three populations have possibly declined in the last decade. The third population has probably increased, but it's the smallest and still we consider it to be quite vulnerable. And also there's been no progress made in reaching the objective set for sensitive status. Regarding public comments we received, we got only 13 comments. Majority of those eight were fine with continued listing of the species as threatened. Two supported endangered listing. Two were opposed to any listing at all. One person was neutral. And then other comments we got, it was obvious that some people were confusing westerns with eastern gray squirrels in their remarks. And also two people thought that there's been greater habitat loss in a couple of the populations than what's indicated in the periodic status review. Regarding recovery needs, we've already begun thinking ahead to the next periodic status review. We should have three important pieces of information for that, and we could possibly prepare this within 3 years or so. But we should have the results of the 2015 to 2017 surveys by that point. We also intend to do a much better analysis of habitat change for the North Cascades and Klickitat populations. And then we also need to complete an assessment of the impacts of the fires in the Okanagan region. And then finally, another recovery need is the need to evaluate whether the voluntary forest practice rule is working for this species or not. And if it's not, it may be time to ask the Forest Practices Board of the DNR to consider a mandatory rule. And do you have any questions?
Questions?
Sorry, I've just got one quick, I hope, quick process question. So some of this information in the recovery needs is going to come to us before, or be available before the next scheduled report. Mm-hmm. And there isn't an uplisting criterion in the plan, but if the population studies were to show a rather severe decline, would you be able to come before the commission for a change in status before the next scheduled report?
Yes, Commissioner Thorburn, I neglected to say that, but definitely if we thought there was evidence of a significant decline in one or more of the populations, and it appeared to us that endangered status was reasonable to go forth with, we would definitely say that in the next status review and come to the commission with that recommendation.
Seeing no other questions? No other questions?
At this Just a point of clarification to Chair Smith. It isn't these little gray squirrels. It's the little ground squirrels that nest in my yard, and they
are digging your hole deeper.
They're nuts.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, well, so we'll move on to sage grouse next. And I'm sure there won't be any questions on this. We'll get you right back on track.
It's all very interesting. It's just the time, but
yeah.
Take your time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Smith, Commissioners. My name is Derek Stinson, and I am going to tell you about the status of the greater sage grouse. Sage grass went through a drastic historical decline in the state, initially through unregulated hunting, and then habitat conversion, particularly of deep soil areas, and then further degradation of the remaining habitat. That decline continued up until the year 2000, and the sage grouse has retreated to about 8% of its historical range. The species was listed, state listed in 1998, and from 2001 to 2015, it enjoyed the status of a distinct population segment under the Endangered Species Act. However, recent genetic research indicated that the western subspecies was not distinct. So in 2015, the Fish and Wildlife Service determined that the Washington population did not meet the criteria to be a DPS, and therefore it was not a listable entity, and they also decided not to list the species range-wide. We completed a recovery plan in 2004, and the objective of that recovery plan was an average spring population of at least 3,200 birds for 10 years, and to have active leks, that is dancing grounds, in six management units. And progress in recovery and conservation is reviewed in this 2013 report that's available on our website. The population of Washington has been relatively stable for the past 20 years. The 2015 estimate was 1,004 with active leks in five management units. If we look a little bit closer at the three populations, we can see that the stability has really depended on the largest population, which is in Douglas County. The next population on the Yakima Training Center went through a long decline that just stabilized in the last few years. And then the bottom line is our Lincoln County reintroduction project that I'll talk about briefly in a minute. Factors affecting sage grouse, it continued habitat loss, fragmentation, degradation, higher populations of ravens. The numbers of ravens have tripled in the last 40 years in the western states. And then a long-term issue is that much of the population in Douglas County is dependent on conservation reserve acreage, and that requires periodic reauthorization by Congress in farm bills. Another huge factor for sage grouse is wildfires past and future that result in the loss of sagebrush, which is a critical food, particularly in the winter. And this can eliminate sagebrush for 30, 40 years. So that's assuming there's a seed source available. If you look at a map of remaining shrub steppe in eastern Washington, it appears that there's plenty of habitat, and one wouldn't understand why there's such an issue, but particularly on the Hanford, the Yakima Reservation, the Yakima Training Center, the Clallam, and the Channel Scablands. However, each of these issues have issues that affect the suitability for sage grouse, whether it's Army training, Interstate 90, lots of power lines in Douglas and Grant County, thin soils in the channel scablands, feral horses on the Yakima Reservation, and repeated wildfires on the Hanford that has largely eliminated sagebrush on most of the area. For conservation actions, one of the big, probably the most important was Conservation Reserve Program, more specifically the newer sage grouse, sharp-tailed grouse SAFE program, and SAFE stands for State Acres for Wildlife Enhancement, and there's now over 60,000 acres in Douglas County. The department, along with BLM, has restored approximately 2,500 acres in Lincoln County since 1996. The Yakima Training Center is currently engaged in restoring sagebrush to 35,000 acres. They also recently expanded their sage grouse protection area to 77,000 acres. The Yakima Nation has erected enclosures to keep out feral horses, and many, many miles of fences have been either removed or marked with plastic markers to make them more visible, because that's a mortality factor for grouse. In addition, there's been three translocation projects. The Yakima Training Center has been doing genetic augmentations. The Yakima Nation has a reintroduction project, and we, along with BLM and WSU, have been doing a reintroduction to Lincoln County. I'll tell you a little bit about that. From 2008 to 2015, we released 277 birds that were captured in Oregon, and our 2015 estimate for Lincoln County was 62 birds and on one established lek. Additional research activities ongoing. We attached satellite transmitter packages to 10 males, and the figure on the left shows the movement of one of the translocated birds that moved from Lincoln County to Douglas County and back, which was kind of an amazing documentation of movement. And the figure on the right is from males, Douglas County males that were tagged, and it shows them in Conservation Reserve Program acres, and that was 5 miles from any native shrub step in an area that previously was not known to be occupied by sage grouse. In addition, modeling for connectivity has been ongoing, to identify areas that are essential for connecting the existing populations and for looking at features of the landscape that inhibit sage grouse movement. In addition, there's three different conservation planning efforts underway. The Sage Grouse Initiative, administered by Natural Resource Conservation Service, is working with ranchers to make their management more compatible with sage grouse. The Douglas County General Conservation Plan that was recently approved by the Fish and Wildlife Service, working with landowners there, and then the Candidate Conservation Agreement with assurances for state and private lands that we are currently engaged in and developing. For continued recovery needs, continued funding of the Conservation Reserve Program in farm bills is critical. Continued emphasis by the BLM, NRCS, Yakima Training Center, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for funding of the Sage Grouse Initiative, for emphasis in the BLM's resource management plan, and for recovery grants. And habitat protection and improvement is essential for connecting existing populations, and improved wildfire prevention and suppression will be very important. In conclusion, there's about 1,000 birds in Washington in four relatively isolated populations. The largest is in Douglas County. It's been relatively stable for 20 years. And our recommendation is that the greater sage grouse remain listed as threatened. We received 13 public comments. 10 supported keeping the sage grouse as threatened. One recommended uplisting, two endangered. One recommended removal of all protection. One suggested a captive rearing project. And one suggested updating the recovery plan and provided 19 pages of management recommendations. I'll entertain questions.
Thank you.
I have no questions about this. I'm pretty familiar with it.
Yeah. Commissioner Thorburn could probably answer most of the questions better than I could.
No, seeing no questions, thank you.
Okay.
Very, very informative.
With that, I'll move on to the snowy plover. The Pacific Coast population of the snowy plover nests on sandy and gravelly substrates along the west coast from Baja North to Pacific and Grays Harbor counties in Washington. They nest from April to July in dry sandy areas. They lay a clutch of three eggs. When the eggs hatch, the males take over and rear the brood, and they often forage on both wet sand and dry sand. The females leave and mate again elsewhere and will produce a second clutch and occasionally a third clutch in the season. And the eggs and chicks are often lost to predation. Plovers have nested in recent years on Midway Beach, a graveyard spit, and Leadbetter Point. They nested on Damon Point up until 2006, and that's a habitat degradation with scotch broom and so on. Ongoing there. Snowy plovers went through a historical decline. There was 78 nesting areas on the West Coast, and that was down to 28 areas by the late 1970s. Threats include development, stabilization of coastal beaches by structures and also introduced beach grasses, human disturbance, as you can imagine, and nest predation. The snowy plover is currently listed as endangered by the state. They were listed in 1981. Recovery plan was completed in 1995. The Pacific Coast population was listed as threatened by the Fish and Wildlife Service in 1993, and a federal recovery plan was completed in 2007. Factors affecting plovers include human disturbance, particularly during nesting season, vehicles straying off the wet sand, busy razor clam digs, dogs off leash, kite flying, and so on. Another important factor is predation, and in Washington, the main culprits are corvids, crows, and ravens, and they probably have increased in number due to the presence of human-associated food sources. And they are a key predator of eggs and chicks.
So we'll just keep the agenda.
And so this issue is being addressed. We began using nest exclosures in 2006, but learned that exclosures may increase predation on both adults and chicks. That's particularly by falcons, both peregrines and then kestrels. Direct predator management by USDA APHIS began in 2013, and it began in Oregon much earlier in 2004. And we've witnessed a fairly dramatic improvement since that time. In 2015, there were 42 pairs that produced 69 to 77 chicks were fledged. That's the highest number since 2007 when we have began consistently collecting that data. In Oregon, predator management also improved productivity dramatically. From 1992 to 2001, plovers produced 351 fledglings, and then from 2004 to 2014, with predator management, they produced 1,286 fledglings. And this improvement is also reflected in our breeding window survey, they call it, with a fairly dramatic increase in number this year. Conservation actions, management of human disturbance using symbolic rope fencing, particularly along a trail that provides access to the state park beach, signage to restrict access from the dry portions of the beach, law enforcement presence by the department and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, particularly during clam tides, portable toilets to reduce intrusions into the closed nesting area during the clam seasons, and timing of those seasons to reduce impacts on nestings and fledglings, and outreach. And we produced this brochure this year that was particularly directed towards razor clamming. Habitat restoration. There's a habitat restoration area on Ledbetter Point, on the which is part of Willow Par National Wildlife Refuge. That's over 400 acres now. It's the largest on the West Coast. And there are smaller restoration areas on Ledbetter State Park and Damon Point. Recovery needs, continued predator management, habitat restoration and maintenance at Ledbetter and Damon Point, management agreements to establish secure nesting areas, and continued cooperation and improvement of the disturbance issue for managing people, outreach, enforcement, and so on. For the state recovery objectives, require an average of at least one fledgling per male each year, and to downlist a threatened requires a four-year average of at least 25 breeding pairs and two or more secure nesting areas. To downlist a sensitive, that requires a four-year average of greater than or equal to 40 breeding pairs and three or more secure nesting areas. Where we're at present, we have averaged at least one fledgling per male in 2011, 2014, and 2015. The four-year average was 22 breeding pairs in 2014, and that went up to 26 in 2015. And we have one nesting area, which is the refuge, which we would probably consider secure. In summary, the snowy plover population has begun to increase as a result of management actions in Washington and Oregon, and there is quite a bit of movement between Washington and Oregon. Oregon has a much larger population. There is a continued need to secure additional habitat and nesting area. It's our recommendation that the snowy plover remain listed as endangered in the state at this time. We received 27 public comments, 26 support keeping the plover as endangered, two expressed support for habitat restoration, two supported predator removal, and four supported reduction of human disturbance. Now I'll entertain questions.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Very, very informative. And we do have two comments, public comments, so take that now. And what we're going to do, Commission, is we're going to, when the conclusion of these comments, we're going to take a 10-minute break and then move on to the other items and just reduce lunch a little bit. Since we were scheduled for a two-hour lunch, we'll just cut that a little bit. So we'll move ahead. So after the comments, we'll take a 10-minute break. So in the comments, Sean again, please, and Robert Sudar, please.
Mr. Chairman, my questions were answered during the presentation.
Thank you, sir.
You're not so lucky on getting rid of me, though.
Go blue, Sean.
Thank you. I am still Sean Cantrell with Defenders of Wildlife. For this comment, I'd also note, while speaking for myself and my organization, I also serve on the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team, which was convened by the Forest Practices Board. And I want to touch two things. One is just to say Defenders of Wildlife supports the recommendations for not changing any of the status of these four species that were presented today. The rest of my comments, I just want to touch a bit on spotted owls. I spoke with you last spring and urged this commission to focus a bit more on the spotted owl issue that unfortunately has not gone away over the last 20 years. As Joe highlighted, the condition has gotten worse. Joe's a great scientist. He's not quite so passionate in his advocacy, which is probably appropriate. So I will pick up where he stopped in saying we really need you all to help weigh in. You know, up to 80% loss in one of those demographic areas over the last 20 years. I mean, this is a crisis for this species. The barred owl competition is a major factor in this population decline, and it needs to be addressed. Habitat loss is also a continuing major factor. And in particular, if you look in the status review information that the department staff provided, there's a chart on page 5 that shows this decline, and Joe talked a bit about. But of all of the habitat loss issues, fire, disease, insects have gotten a fair amount of attention in the media over the last several years, and those are significant. But 72% of all the spotted owl habitat that's been lost in the last 20 years is because of harvest. And the vast majority of that, almost 90% of that has been lost, is from harvest on private or on non-federal lands. And I mention this because the state's authority is really on the non-federal lands. The non-federal, where there isn't much harvest or habitat loss, you guys don't have any authority really to manage that. But on state lands, state agencies do have significant influence. The Washington Forest Practice Board, which you have a seat on, Deputy Director Storr represents the department on there, helps set the rules, and those rules need to be updated. The federal recovery plan, as well as this status review, both speak to that. This status review says, quote, the current rules may be insufficient. I would say they are insufficient. So I would encourage you to have your representative on the State Forest Practice Board, Deputy Director Storr, use that Bowie pulpit to try to make sure that we are updating these rules. They last were updated in 1996, so 20 years ago, and we've seen this decline. So addressing that habitat loss on non-federal lands is a very important and valuable opportunity for this department and the commission. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Any questions of Sean?
Yeah, I just would like it. So, Sean, what I'm hearing you say, Defenders is okay with lethal owl control.
Barred owl control. We support the existing study that's going on. That study then needs to make recommendations for an ongoing management regime, because studying the effectiveness of it and looking at what the cost, et cetera, is really what that EIS process is about, and we're 1 year into a 4-year study. We support that study.
Thank you. And then the flip side of that is you're saying, please don't forget the other aspect of management, which is the habitat.
Exactly.
Needs to retain the importance while we're looking at the barred owls.
Exactly. Again, one of the slides in Joe's presentation talks about recovery needs, and it addresses the voluntary incentives that for non-federal lands, talks about barred owl control. But I would urge you to have Deputy Director Storr help raise the issue of updating the regulatory regime for spotted owls as well.
Thanks, Sean.
Great. Thank you.
With that, we will... I'm sorry, Joe.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of information for the commission. We will be briefing the Forest Practices Board in February and I believe in April on those species that are related to forest practices, and northern spotted owls have received a lot of discussion so far, and I think board members will be interested in hearing the briefing and considering next steps. So,
good, and then you'll report back after.